Again, this is Adam Lowe, the Executive Director of NACIP. Thank you again for your participation today. Your participation in the accreditation peer review process is critical to the success of NACIP. Accreditation is the core service that NACIP provides our members, and it's an important source of our positive reputation as an organization nationally. To ensure broad credit acceptance for concurrent enrollments and prevent excessive regulatory oversight and backlash from those people who are skeptical of concurrent enrollment, our standards and accreditation really do help legitimize concurrent enrollment by demonstrating that it is possible for high school instructors to teach authentic college courses to high school students. The U.S. higher education system is really premised on the belief that institutions have primary responsibility for academic quality. Generally speaking, our federal and state governments do not write or approve our curricula, examine the credentials of our faculty, or review the performance of students, unlike in other countries where ministries of education take on these functions. Third-party peer review accreditation carried out by nonprofit organizations such as NACIP is thus the primary means by which colleges, universities, and programs monitor quality in the United States. Your role providing an objective evaluation of your peers' concurrent enrollment programs is something we value very highly. As many of you know, last year NACIP took an important step to demonstrate the importance and the value of accreditation by separating the accreditation process from NACIP's governing board, creating an independent accreditation commission comprised of 8 elected and appointed individuals who represent our accredited membership. Several positions will be coming available next year, and if you enjoy this accreditation review process and want to get further involved, you might consider serving on the commission itself. Above all, we ask that you treat the process of accreditation with professionalism. Applicants have put in countless hours into their applications, and an accreditation review is high stakes for some people's institutions and some people's careers and reputations. Confidentiality is something that we take very seriously. We ask that you take the contents of the application, names of your peer review team members, discussions or communications about the application. All of these things should be considered to be confidential materials. The recommendations of your peer review teams, you should only be communicating those types of information to your coordinating commission or other members of the commission, including the chair, as well as staff at NACIP. If you have any questions regarding whether something is confidential or not, please do ask rather than go on the assumption that information is public. We will ask you to sign a reviewer agreement that will attest to the fact that you have no conflict of interest with the application that has been assigned to you. This should be either a real conflict of interest or any activity that might be considered a potential conflict of interest. If you're an alumni of the college or university whose program you've been assigned to review, then we're going to ask you to step off that peer review team and serve on another peer review team. If you're a former employee of that institution or if you have some other financial or other relationship or even any sort of perceived interest in the outcome of the review. If your college or university serves students in the same state or service area as the applicant that you're being asked to review, again, that would be a perceived conflict of interest. And if you provide any consulting work or professional services to concurrent enrollment programs on a fee-for-service basis, we do ask that that you recuse yourself from serving as a peer reviewer during the time period under which you are earning money from providing professional services to other concurrent enrollment programs. When we send you the conflict of interest forms and reviewer agreement, if you have any questions, please do let us know. Some logistics. We do have this conference call line and a number of conference call lines available to support your team. And the NACIP office can coordinate that. Tanisha Langhorn, who many of you have dealt with, is scheduling those right now, although she's moving to Atlanta later this summer, and we will be having a new staff member come on board. Most importantly, when you are asked to review an application, we will send you a link to that application. We accept applications only electronically, and they are stored on a secure password-protected file storage service called Box. The easiest way for you to conduct your review is to download the entire application to your hard drive. It will come in a compressed zip format. Both Windows and Macs can decompress those files. And if you have any technical problems, certainly do let us know. Once you have downloaded it to your hard drive, then you can just access all the files as they are available locally. You can also get into the files and preview them using the Box system, but that is not 100% foolproof in that some files will not display properly, including many of the cover sheets that applicants are using. Applicants will be using a standard folder structure. Those of you who have recently gone through accreditation or reaccreditation will see this as quite familiar. Each standard should have a folder, and within that folder, all the cover sheet as well as the evidence that they provide will be within that folder. Paired syllabi and paired assessments, if they provide separate assessments from syllabi, will be in their own folders, as well as the assessment standard forms. These are the forms that faculty liaisons sign off on attesting to the implementation of certain standards. I wanted to just give you a sort of introduction to how we expect the process to go and your role as a peer reviewer for those of you who are new at doing this in particular. One of the primary, at the heart of an accreditation process is program improvement. Each of the applicants has completed a self-study and spent quite a bit of time compiling evidence documenting the practices and policies that they have in place. Accreditation is an evaluative process, and so you are asked to assess the evidence to determine whether or not the standards are in place. We do ask that you treat this as a collegial and meaningful professional review. Don't think of yourself as an inspector or an auditor trying to catch violators, but rather a critical friend who's looking to see the work of a peer. Applicants are required to have all 17 standards in place and documented at the time that they apply, and that you are assessing whether or not those policies and procedures and practices meet or exceed the NACEP standards. The burden of proof on meeting the standards is on the applicant, and the burden of proof on demonstrating that the standards are in place is on the applicant. Certainly, you are going to ask them for clarification and additional documentation if you're uncertain about whether or not a standard is in place. But ultimately, they have to demonstrate to you that the standard is in place. It's not up to you to dig around and find evidence that an applicant has put something in place. Be aware that each concurrent enrollment program uses unique language and procedures, and they operate in the context of the institutional and state policy in which they are located. This may, in fact, will be different than the unique environment. They may not do things exactly the same as you do things. What you're looking for is whether or not they do what is required of them from the standards. There are many ways to thus Thank you. All right. Can people hear me now? I see a number of you on the chat window. Apparently, the operator was called in for some reason, but they seem to have resolved it. The last thing is that while each standard must be met individually, we do ask that you look at an application holistically. Some programs utilize site visits much more intensively than others, and others utilize on-campus professional development more intensively than others. You're looking for a balance, an interaction between the two, to show that the program is meeting all of the standards. in terms of the structure of your accreditation review, each peer review team is made up of three individuals. The commission will designate the team leader for each group. This will always be a veteran reviewer. The team leader is the one who will be responsible for written electronic communication with the applicant. This person may take notes for your team and be the recorder for your team, or they may ask another member of the team to do that function if that's helpful for them. The team leader will thus be responsible for ensuring that the review form is completed and submitted to the commission, and your commissioner is available as a resource to you. If you've got questions about interpretation of the standards, if you have questions about the process, please do contact that coordinating that commissioner who's been assigned to coordinate your application. They are there as a liaison and resource for you. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Kim, who's going to talk about the timeline of the review process.
Thanks, Adam. So you can see on your screen kind of the first step of doing the review. Going underway right now is the coordinating commissioners are screening the applications, and the goal of this is to make sure that the application is ready for you to review and that it includes all the relevant documents that you will need, that all the links work, the files are organized appropriately. It's important to note that just because a commissioner passes an application on to a peer review team, that does not indicate that the program is accreditable. The coordinating commissioner has not done a substantive review of all the evidence. It's just to make sure that it's ready for you to review. So once the application is passed along to the review team, which will happen in mid-August, at this point, it's your job to identify any deficiencies in the application and determine what information your team needs to make a final decision. Your team will schedule a review team conference call by mid-September. Before that call, you should read through all the application materials so that you can be prepared to discuss it on the call with your peer review team. Make sure that you will be prepared to discuss the evidence that was provided for each standard, and that you are able to identify those needs on that first phone call. On that call, you will then identify what things are lacking in the application and where you need to request additional clarification or ask additional documentation from the applicant prior to the interview. So by October 1st, you will have your first request for additional evidence, and then go ahead and change to the next slide, Adam. And then at this point, we will schedule interviews with all the applicants. For those who are attending the NASA conference, that's when this interview will take place. And if the applicant does not attend the conference, then we will schedule an interview with them at a later date for a teleconference. It is important that your applicants receive the initial request for additional evidence sufficiently in advance of this interview. You know, at least 2 weeks so that they have time to prepare before this interview and understand what you're asking for. If at the end of that interview there were additional things that were identified that they also need to be included, that will be required at the first response from the applicant. So everything that you've identified in your first call, as well as anything that's been identified during the applicant interviews, will be required from the first response from the applicant that will happen in mid-January. At this point, if there are significant concerns with certain standards that you do not believe they will be resolved with further review, at this point, it's better for you to raise those concerns with your coordinator or your chair as early as possible so that the chair can contact the applicant to discuss the viability of continuing the review. At this point, a recommendation to accredit or deny should not be made until after the team has reviewed this first response. So when you're giving the first request for more evidence, when you're at the applicant interviews, at this point you're not expressing whether you believe that they're going to be accredited or denied accreditation, and a recommendation should not be made yet until you get that first response from the applicant with the additional documentation that you have asked for. Moving on. Okay, so after you've gotten that first response from your applicant, at this point your team will have another call to discuss the additional evidence that they've received. On the second call, you will discuss the applicant's response and its impact on the application. And it's at this point that the team will decide to recommend to the coordinating commissioner and the accreditation commission chair one of the following, whether the application will be approved for accreditation or whether the application be denied accreditation. Do not notify the applicant of your recommendation. The accreditation commission chair will take care of all notifications once the commission makes a final decision. So throughout this entire process, please do not notify the applicant of your recommendation. At this point, the team might also decide that additional clarification or documentation is still necessary to make a final determination. This should be the final request for additional evidence. So if you do make a second and final request for additional evidence, then moving on to the last slide of the timeline, you will then have a third review team conference call if that's necessary to discuss the new information and, again, to make a recommendation to the coordinating commissioner and accreditation commission chair. And just another reminder again, please do not recommend, do not notify the applicant of your recommendation. The commission chair will take care of all of that once they meet together. At some point in April, that is when you as a review team will submit your final report to the coordinating commissioner and chair. We will get that final date to you at some point in the future when we figure out when the accreditation commission will be meeting. And then, you know, by May 1st, the commission will be meeting together to vote and to approve or deny and make that final decision. So that is the timeline. If there's any questions on anything that Adam and I have said so far, please feel free to put them in the message box. And at this point, I will turn it over to Victoria.
Great. Thank you. Can everyone hear me?
Yep.
Okay, good. So now I'm going to get into nitty-gritty about the review form and then the standards that the application that the applicant is trying to meet. So the review form here is really your kind of note-taking strategy. It's going to document your review team's discussions. It will include areas there for you to indicate what additional evidence you're asking for. It's really a nice way to organize your notes in preparation for the final report rubric that you're going to be giving to your coordinating commissioner. You want to make sure that you're documenting your team's conclusions and everything there so that really the commissioner has all the information that they'll need to present to the rest of the commission who will then vote on accreditation and also to help prepare a letter that will go to the applicant which gives recommendations and so on about the review process. On this form, you're not to indicate anything as far as whether a standard has been met or not. Some teams have found that when they ask for additional evidence from the applicants, they like to just write a letter as opposed to showing them this actual review form. That's kind of up to you. The letter process can be less intimidating, I think, than sending an applicant a 19-page packet, which has all of your notes. So consider this an area for you to just be able to document your discussions, and then you might consider writing a separate letter that's just pulling out the kinds of evidence and so on that you're asking for applicants. Now, the first part of the application is the program description. Now, this should be relatively easy to deal with because basically you just start checking off and the information just that it's there. This isn't an actual standard for an ASEP. But the program description is still really important. It's giving context and background for your review. It's helping to familiarize you with the history and the size of the program, how the program fits within the institution as a whole, any state policies or laws that are going to affect concurrent enrollment. So It still is really important. You don't want to ignore it because, let's say, later on, if you start having questions about how, let's say, site visits or professional development or orientation is done, and then you see, oh, this program only has 12 teachers, that might end up answering a lot of your questions. So you really do want to pay attention to this, even though it's not a standard. So if they don't mention any state policies or laws, it is helpful, you know, you can just ask outright to the applicant, is there anything that they might have left out, you know, that might be relevant. An organizational chart is recommended, but it's not required. Again, you can ask for it if it would help place the program in context. Now, we, when the applicant submitted their intent to apply for accreditation, they had to submit their list of disciplines that they're going to be using for their application, and the commissioners approve that list of disciplines. So the discipline list that you see coming with the program description, that has already gone under kind of one review to see that it seems a fair representation of the size and scope of the program. That should hopefully help ease things for reviewers this time. You're not going to need to sign a second guess how a discipline was defined. But you'll want to make sure that you're checking how many disciplines are listed so that later on when there are standards that say you need to have something for every discipline, you can quickly kind of match up. Like, okay, they say there's math. Is there something for math? And so on. Okay. Now, on here, you can see that in the program description, there are basically check boxes here. And so this is on your review form. You will have a spot there so you can just start filling in the numbers, anything that is not there that the applicant didn't fill in that you gathered from the evidence, so the number of disciplines and so on. And you can see there an example of 14 disciplines, and here are the types of areas. So it's really nice to put that on the review form for yourself just so you're not constantly going back to your box files to pull this. Just have it saved, easy to access on your review form. Now, the curriculum standards. One thing, I'm going to probably try to go kind of quickly through some of these just because I want to make sure we have plenty of time for anything. And so all of you being accredited programs hopefully are pretty familiar with the standards and the intent of the standards. My focus is going to be really on highlighting some of the things that have sometimes tripped up review teams in the past. So one thing to note is that we're only listing the required evidence on these slides. We took out the piece that says additional evidence may be submitted. That's just for brevity's sake. So now for C1, the list of concurrent enrollment courses that the applicant provides is supposed to be publicly available. Sometimes programs will submit a list of the courses, and it's not apparent whether that list is easily located on the college or CEP programs websites. The programs have been asked to make it easy for you to locate the CEP courses within their main catalog, and they'll usually use a bookmarking feature in Adobe to do this. But if it's not clear how this list is available or how the courses are known about, ask the applicants. That's something that hopefully according commissioners are spotting in advance as part of their screening. But if you don't see it, feel free to ask. Another issue that comes up is variation between the college catalog and the concurrent enrollment course descriptions. The descriptions really should be identical. If the differences that you see relate to prerequisites, these will be later addressed in S2. But when there are some differences, what teams are asked to do is to clarify with the applicant why there was a difference, and in some cases it might be necessary to have something submitted from the pertinent faculty member or dean approving of any variation. There might be a really legitimate reason for why there's a variation. Remember that articulated credit, like might be the case for Project Lead the Way, is not concurrent enrollment, and so it shouldn't be part of this application narrative or documentation. We've done a lot of prep with applicants that hopefully they all understand only include concurrent enrollment courses in their application, but that is something to note. You might see when you're looking at websites or other things mentions of their other articulated kind of credit, but really you're just going to be focusing on the concurrent enrollment piece for this application. Now for C2, most programs are using the A1, A2, A3, C2 assessment standard form that NACEP provides. This year, the applicants were asked to post these letters only once in the specified folder on BoxNet inside the assessment folder. However, you may find that forms were also posted in the C2 folder, which is perfectly fine. But if you don't see it in C2, then go to the A folder and you'll find it in there, that standard form. Now, these forms, there should be one that is signed for every discipline as defined in the program description. The form should include a description of how the standards met. Generally, this is going to refer to the orientation and professional development, site visits, and other ways that they might be sharing curricular resources. The most common program that I would see is that liaisons might sign the form and then not put in any description because there's a box on the form for including description, and some of them will just leave it blank, only signing the form. To help remedy that problem, I've noticed that some applicants will basically prep the liaison and write a description for them, and you might even see that the same description is on each form. Don't get kind of caught, you know, like hung up on that. It's okay if it ends up having the same basic description, because we imagine that there is going to be a lot of stuff that the programs are all doing the same. It's all right if it's the same description. You're looking to see that the liaison has signed off on it, and then figure that the evidence that all those things like orientation, professional development, site visits, that all that kind of stuff is happening, you're going to see that evidence later on in your C3, F2, F3 areas, okay? You're not looking for evidence for that evidence right here. It's okay if the applicant basically wrote up something for the liaison, but you're looking for signed forms. Let's see, and if you see that information is missing, it's okay to ask the applicant for that information. So if a liaison just signed a form and then there's nothing there included, we've had applicants go back and ask the liaisons for a description, and maybe they end up just writing an email with a description of what they do, and then that comes back as your supplemental evidence. Now for C3, there should be a completed site visit form for each discipline, again, as defined in the program description. It's becoming more common now for liaison signatures to be electronic due to site visit forms being completed and submitted electronically for the program. That's okay. Again, don't get hung up, don't get hung up on having an actual signature on the form if you see that the standard is being substantially implemented and the fact that faculty are producing the reports. You're only going to start getting maybe hung up, concerned about signatures if you start seeing that there are other problems happening in this standard. You know, that might just be just one piece of the puzzle. If you see that there are other problems, then maybe come back to, you know, what's going on with the signatures. But if that's the only issue, don't get hung up. Some of the common mistakes are that some programs won't have evidence of a clear tracking system or frequency of requirements for doing site visits. This is probably most common in smaller programs. NACEP recommends that new concurrent enrollment instructors are visited in their first year and then placed on the certain frequency schedule after that, if not an annual visit. And, you know, sometimes that more veteran teachers are visited kind of, you know, less often. That's okay. That's understood, where newer teachers will be visited more often. Another issue that we've seen is perhaps a lack of a standard site visit form. Or perhaps that they have a form, but it doesn't really clearly address the kinds of areas that that a program is going to want to care about, you know, areas of concern for alignment purposes. You know, you should see on the site visit form that there's some way for liaisons to indicate alignment around course outlines, textbooks, you know, assessments, grading, anything like that. And to and there are all different ways that, that they do this with check boxes, narrative, and so on. There's no one standard site visit form that that we're looking for, but you want this is something that especially smaller programs will often struggle with, and they might need some of, again, as a critical friend, some of your guidance to help them. And if they don't have, if they're doing site visits but they don't have a really great form for doing it or way of tracking, this is something where your expertise could be really helpful to them. Another concern sometimes is where there's minimal or no description of any feedback or follow-up process, especially when the liaison notes problems on the form. I remember recalling a program when multiple forms, they were haphazardly completed, there were minimal descriptions, no indication whether the syllabi, the assessments, anything was aligned. You know, generally teams can assume that an applicant is going to be selecting the best examples of site visit forms. So if you're seeing problems, it's really worth delving into. So you might ask for additional site visit forms, an explanation of what the follow-up procedures are when any concerns are raised by liaisons. A description of maybe the process that the program uses to train liaisons in how to do site visits. So, you know, keep in mind and throughout this application process that the applicant is choosing the best they have, so when you see problems, you know, don't ignore them. Moving on to faculty standards. For F1, the key points here are to keep in mind that the approvals are coming from the academic departments. Even if there exists some kind of state-mandated criteria, or criteria from their regional accreditor or something around instructor credentials. It's not the state or the regional accreditor that's approving the instructors. It's the college and the academic area. So you want to see that the approvals are coming from them. In some cases, it might be another person, some kind of academic dean, or department chair that's doing these approvals. I mean, that's okay. The key is that it's someone with academic qualifications, not your HR office or the concurrent enrollment program administrator that's making the call. It's always someone with the academic qualifications to make a decision around who gets to teach these classes. There should also be approval letters that are sent back to the instructors before they teach the class. The approval letters, there is no, you know, NACEP kind of recommended format or anything. What we usually end up recommending to programs and what review teams usually recommend to applicants is standardizing their approval form. Again, sometimes smaller programs might just have a very loose process of sending an email to an applicant that's maybe kind of vague and lets them know sort of what their status is. But sometimes, especially as programs get larger, they're encouraged to have maybe a more standardized approval letter that's very clear about, you know, who's the person who's been approved and specifically what courses are they approved to teach. And then if there are certain follow-up things that they need to do. So, you know, how are they going to get their orientation? You know, what are some of the other kind of requirements that they now have to complete to set up their accounts and move forward with teaching the class? So, so that is the approval letter. There also should be something describing what the denial process is. So we're not looking for an actual application from an applicant that's been denied, just a denial letter. In some cases, a program may not have ever denied anyone. And if that's the case, then you would expect the applicant to really describe what their screening process is. You know, how have they been able to not have any denials? Usually, it's because maybe they're having such a good screening process up front and educating schools and teachers about what the requirements are going to be that they end up filtering out basically anyone that isn't qualified before even sending an application on to the faculty. So then you would want to see, you know, what's their screening process, and then how would they handle things if there was a denial there. And so, again, as a review team, you might even find yourself sharing kind of an example or ideas, especially if it's a program that really has never had a denial. They might not have fully in place, like a letter or something, what they would do around a denial. But they should at least be able to describe their screening process. Now on as we're getting into F2 and F3, as you probably realize, these are really two standards that are at the heart of NACEP, and they really are, unfortunately, they're probably the most common standards, the trip-up programs, the trip-up applicants. So things to keep in mind, an administrative and discipline-specific training should be delivered before the course is offered for the first time. There's no minimum number of contact hours defined, you know, and for this, and the format is not defined as well by NACEP. So sometimes the training might be for multiple instructors at the same time. Maybe it's one-on-one. It can really happen anywhere, any format. Some programs will do things with webinars, with meetings. There are all different ways that this kind of training, this orientation can happen. The evidence that they submit should include materials from two different disciplines, but not simply an invitation or an agenda. So you're going to want to see something more substantial than that. So as it says here, sometimes that might include attendance reports and so on, participant evaluations. If the orientation is a one-on-one orientation, there's going to be a lot of leeway in the allowable evidence. You know, having a participant evaluation doesn't really make sense for something one-on-one. So, you know, there is going to be a lot of flexibility depending on what the format is that they're using in the program. But there, it should be clear, you know, what are they covering? What are the kinds of topics? And seeing, you know, does this make sense? Like, as far, you know, are they covering all the administrative and discipline specific kinds of things that a teacher needs to know before they delve into teaching the class? We also ask for the administrative guide. Many programs will combine their administrative guide and the student guide. That's okay as long as you see that all the instructor responsibilities are covered in there. And so that is one thing to note. And there are different ways that, again, this might be done, whether it's a handbook or a website with links, all different ways. Again, format doesn't really matter. What you're looking at is just the content there, and do instructors, are they getting that information? Do they know how to access it and how to get kind of their questions answered when they need help? One thing I didn't mention as far as some of the evidence with the orientation and looking at attendance reports, you see there an example that shows like a sign-in sheet. A sign-in sheet is not the only way to show attendance. Programs, you know, a lot of us were using Excel and various databases and such to track participation and things, you know, or you might have things via email and stuff. You're looking for an evidence that there's some kind of, you know, tracking that they know who needs an orientation and did they get it. Seeing an actual sign-in sheet is not what's most important, so don't get hung up on that and requesting a sign-in sheet if you see other evidence that they know kind of that the orientation is taking place and who's participating. Okay. And that, you know, and that maybe that there's, that there's some kind of follow-up, to see, you know, if someone doesn't show up, what's the follow-up action to that? Now for F3, so our annual professional development. So again, this one is a tough standard for programs. There are a lot of different methods that programs can use for providing professional development. Traditional kind of formats, you know, conferences, workshops, some non-traditional ones. There might be, you know, a journal article discussion, brainstorming on effective pedagogical methods. There could be webinars or other things that are not face-to-face. Really, the key is that you're looking for activities that are kind of ongoing, robust, and meaningful, and provides for some kind of interactivity. You really, if a program is showing that all that they're doing just things like department meetings, where the bulk of the discussion is about how to make photocopies or do payroll, or presentations on how to register students, that's not really considered to be meaningful professional development. Yes, some of those kinds of things might happen as part of the overall experience. You know, yes, we need to make sure that our teachers know how to register students and do some of these other administrative tasks, but that shouldn't be all that professional development encompasses. We're really looking at documenting that there is professional development that is really helping that instructor in the classroom, you know, with teaching their courses, with understanding the discipline expectations and requirements. You want to see that that the professional development is actually being implemented, not just that there's an invitation to attend. So, you know, the actual agendas and evidence that that it really did take place. So some programs will submit slides and PowerPoints, things like that. There are all different ways that they might show, you know, what happened. Maybe it's a summary from the liaison about what they discussed, maybe a description of the workshop that was provided, all different kinds of ways that you can show more detail about the professional development, not just what invitation you might have, like flyer or email you might have sent out to your teachers letting them know that PD was occurring, but just more detail about what actually happened in each discipline. In addition, as we said, the professional development, you know, it must occur annually, and the teacher participation needs to be tracked. The tracking evidence can vary, just like with the orientation. Don't get hung up on seeing an actual sign-in sheet. Yes, a lot of programs are probably doing some kind of sign-in process to if they're doing like a conference day perhaps, but there are various ways they might do professional development. Maybe a sign-in sheet isn't there, but they need to show some kind of way they're doing the tracking, you know, an example from their database or something, and be able to explain that. What is their tracking method? Also, while this professional development must occur annually, it's the program that is setting the schedule for teachers' attendance. So the schedule is something that should be part of F4, your noncompliance policy, and it's communicated to teachers. So so that kind of required evidence for three here is where the team is going to determine if this policy is being applied fairly to all the CEP instructors in the program. Moving on to F4, so as I mentioned before, so this is the noncompliance. The point here with F4 is to see that the program has a policy and a way to take action if an instructor is not complying with any aspect of the program or course requirements. It's not to verify that an instructor has actually been decertified. And so it mentions there in F4 about non-participation in training or activities, and that's oftentimes where F4 comes up. It's around professional development. But again, you might include that there might be other things that that program's including as far as reasons for decertifying an instructor. You know, they're not following through with some of the administrative responsibilities that they have. You know, they're not sticking to prerequisites or registering students appropriately. Or, you know, they're not following the course outline. Something was identified in a site visit that leads to a liaison wanting to pull the course. You know, there might be lots of reasons why an instructor can be seen as being non-compliant. Now, the policy should in some way be a part of the F2 orientation. You imagine that these policies, the main way to publicize it to instructors, you know, what the expectations are is including it in the orientation in the administrative guide. So if a program says, yeah, this is our F4, but you see that it's not included anywhere in the administrative guide, that, you know, that would be something there that the program should take some action on, that the applicant should change and remedy. Again, oftentimes instructors who are non-compliant are given second chances, third chances to become compliant. That is okay. And so now I see that I'm seeing mostly in the text box a lot of just other comments, but I'm taking it that there aren't questions on the F standards or the C standards. And so then we can move on to the student standards.
Thanks. This is Adam, and I'm going to go through the student standards. And if you do have questions about the faculty and curriculum standards, please do go ahead and use the text box, and Victoria can answer them while I'm talking about the student standards. The intent of student standard one is that to confirm that registration policies and practices are as consistent as possible with on-campus policies. And to confirm that concurrent enrollment students receive an official college transcript. There are different classifications that colleges and universities use for concurrent enrollment students, and this really varies depending on the policies of the institution. What is important is that they're registered for the course in the college's academic record system at the beginning of the semester and not retroactively awarded credit or allowed to enroll after trying out the course for most of the semester. This letter needs to come from the college registrar, whatever senior administrator is in charge of academic records at that institution, if they don't use that title, and ought to be on letterhead. Most of the words used in these letters are the standard verbatim language copying our standard, and that's fine. Others will go into more detail describing the registration process in that letter itself. Programs do need to describe the registration process in their cover sheet. Not required, but often a program will submit a sample transcript for a concurrent enrollment student. Personal details should be redacted. If you feel that would be beneficial for your review to see a sample transcript, then certainly you should go ahead and ask for that in the request for additional information. Common questions that arise with this standard are sequences of courses that are held over two semesters. So if the course is offered over a full academic year for concurrent enrollment, that can be acceptable as long as the academic standards are upheld and students are enrolled early in that first semester. Another is the timeline for add, drop, withdrawal, medical withdrawals, expunging grades and policies for repeating courses. These things, concurrent enrollment students should be treated as consistently as possible with the college's practices for on-campus courses. And so if that's not evident from the description that they provide in the cover sheet, you should feel free to go ahead and ask questions about those timelines and how they match up with what's on campus. Student Standard 2 addresses prerequisites to confirm the concurrent enrollment and on-campus students meet the same course prerequisites. Now, for many colleges, they have published requirements course by course level. In some cases, this is done at the departmental level, and so you're looking to see what the college publishes in the course catalog or other official materials with regards to prerequisites, whether it is placement tests or having taken a prior course in a sequence. If those requirements are in place for on-campus students, then they ought to be in place for concurrent enrollment students as well. Some common issues that arise in this are when the eligibility guidelines or registration process is not readily available to students. And so you want to look for how do students learn what prerequisites are necessary in order to take a course. In some cases, we have some states and some institutions that have program eligibility requirements that a student must meet certain standards in order to enter into any concurrent enrollment course. While that's related to this, what you're really looking for here are the course prerequisite standards and that those are consistent. And so one of the things you should also look for is the process by which the college verifies that prerequisites are met. Who is responsible for doing that and how is that information conveyed to the college? With regards to Student Standard 3, the intent of this is to confirm that concurrent enrollment students know about concurrent enrollment and the college's policies and the consequences of not adhering to those policies. We describe it in the standard as a comprehensive publication. For some institutions, that is a printed student concurrent enrollment student handbook that is provided to each and every student who takes a concurrent enrollment course. In other cases, that's an electronic document, perhaps a PDF, or a series of documents that are on a web page. What I think is critical is that you look to see that students are not merely just referred to an online student handbook for all students at the institution. Some policies, rights, and responsibilities may be the same for both concurrent enrollment students and the general student body, but there are going to be differences for registration processes and other information that's critical for the concurrent enrollment student to know. So a typical college student handbook is generally not sufficient to count as a concurrent enrollment handbook if their students are not given guidance as to regards to which parts apply or don't apply and differ from a matriculated college student. If this information is available solely online, ask for how students are made aware of their rights and responsibilities, how they are directed to go online and make sure that that information is conveyed. We see some programs that will send someone out to the high schools to do a kind of a briefing, your rights and responsibilities as a concurrent enrollment student, you know, talk about plagiarism, talk about appeals processes and the like. With that, I'm going to hand it back over to Victoria to talk about the assessment standards.
Okay, great. Thanks, Adam. So just again, a quick reminder about the application structure. Within the main assessment folder, there are four subfolders, A1, A2, A3, and the NACEP assessment standard forms. This is one of those areas where most programs are using the standard form that NACEP provides for the liaisons to sign off on. A general comment about the A standards, they refer to the assessment of student performance, not instructor quality. But if F2 and F3 are weak, generally the A standards will be weak too. Without robust and meaningful professional development, it makes sense that the CP instructors, they won't know what the assessment expectations of that institution and department are. So some key points. You're going to be looking for evidence confirming that the concurrent enrollment course is as equivalent as possible to the on-campus course. So keeping an eye for the same level of rigor in the assessments, looking for expectations about the level of rigor, the learning outcomes, course objectives, or performance level descriptions, you know, whatever terminology they're using there. The paired syllabi, they should be actual syllabi, not just templates or common course outlines. An applicant might also include that you know, as part of their description of how they ensure alignment, that yes, we have a template that everyone completes, and so they might provide that. But then in addition, you're going to be looking for paired syllabi for every course, I mean, for every discipline. And again, the number of disciplines, it's matching the number of disciplines that were provided in the program description. Okay, so the number and the type of the form should match that. You're looking to see that the concurrent enrollment and the on-campus students are being assessed using basically the same methods. And so that's the A3 standards. But some of that is going to be evident in the documentation provided for A1. Okay, so while A1 is focused just on the syllabi, you're going to start to see evidence kind of for these other A standards in there. So now on evidence 3, it mentions this detailed description. There's a lot of variation in how programs do that. Most programs, I think, just provide this within the cover sheet, and that's totally okay. It doesn't have to be a separate document. Really, the description, it makes sense. It's a narrative that the program is providing. So having it in the cover sheet is okay. You don't need to be looking for a totally separate document or anything. For A2, this here is where, you know, applicants are going to say oftentimes that this is happening, you know, that the grading is aligned. But what you're really looking for, again, it's the evidence that there is a process and a means by which campus faculty are engaged in this. So, you know, and how do they know that the grading is being aligned? So sometimes what you'll see for supporting materials are grade comparison reports, maybe descriptions of how campus rubrics or curves are conveyed to CEP instructors. You might see collaborative grading activities to help norm grades. That's a lot of times that's something you might see in annual professional development, where they have some kind of grade norming activities taking place. And so that is very common. Grading on the same scale does not guarantee that the level of work for which an A is awarded is the same in both classrooms. So seeing that a grade of 92 to 95 equals an A in a campus course and a CEP course, that's just one small piece of the puzzle. How do we know still that A or that 92 is the same in both areas? If it's something objective like everything is all just tests, all right, that then is pretty clear. But what about for something that's more subjective, you know, as far as like, let's say, in English and history and so on? And if it's something that it's just purely based on objective assessments like tests, well, then in your A3, you're going to be wanting to look to see, well, are the tests equivalent as far as rigor? I see there, okay, so there was some clarification there about what standards of achievement. So, again, there's a lot of different terminology for what standards of achievement are and how they're referred to in course syllabi or outlines. And so, you know, basically it's the idea, you know, what are the learning outcomes? Like, what are students supposed to be able to do? What are they supposed to know by the end of the course? Now, for A3, so this is focused on what the actual assessment tools, strategies are. And this is something that can get kind of complicated, trip people up, because it says there that required evidence that paired syllabi are okay. But the fact is that there are very few syllabi that actually give enough information that allows one to judge how equivalent the assessments really are. Usually you're going to find yourself, if someone only supplied syllabi, you might find yourself asking for samples of paired assessments, and that's totally okay. And so you'll want to look at then, you know, do you need paired assessments from every discipline or maybe just from a subset of disciplines? It's going to kind of depend on, I guess, you know, what the disciplines are and how concerned you are about that and whether the alignment's there. The paired assessments, they should be in a similar format to one another. So, you know, essay compared to an essay or things are, if it, this is a course where things are all multiple choice, then that's what you might see then from the concurrent enrollment. And so also when a program's providing paired assessments, they should cover similar topics or concepts because that will make it, again, easier to see if things, if there's really alignment as far as the expectations there, the assessment rigor. And so, you know, as so as far as the same assessment strategies being used, so if you see, for example, that the on-campus final is a multiple-choice exam with three short essays, the CP final should be should not really be just like matching fill-in-the-blank with no essay. It's pretty obvious there that that's not really at the same level of rigor. So, yes, you know, they may not be always exactly question for question same, but they should be very comparable. Some programs take care of this by having common final exams, but not every program is going to have common exams or assessments. And so this is going to become important. And again, you might find that in professional development that programs are going to spend time designing some assessment tools, sharing assessment strategies, and so on. That's going to be one way that a program might help show that, you know, we really are paying attention to this and doing what we can to ensure alignment in assessments. Thanks, Adam, for helping with some of the questions there. I think if it's clear about what's going on with assessments, I guess we can move on unless there are any last questions that are going to pop up. But but as you know, Adam says, really the assessments, you've got A1 is really the learning outcomes, A2 is about alignment and grading, and A3 is about alignment in the assessment strategies there. So that's kind of how they break down, and of course they're all very interconnected. Okay. Let's see. We are ready to move on to Adam then.
Okay. Thanks, Victoria. So program evaluation standards, and again, continue in the chat window for further clarification on the assessment standards while we move on to program evaluation. The program evaluation standards one is end-of-course student assessments evaluations. For all the evaluation standards, we ask to see the survey instruments. Sometimes programs will forget to provide a blank copy or provide a copy with an individual results on it. So do look for a copy of the instrument and not solely the compilation and the analysis of the results. What you're looking for sometimes with online surveys is, you know, they'll have to be creative in terms of how they provide you with a copy of that survey method. One of the things to notice about this evaluation standard is that each course must be evaluated every time it's offered for a concurrent enrollment. This is often above and beyond the expectations for on-campus faculty or adjuncts. And so this is one area where our standards sometimes require more frequent and implementation of a process than an institution would do on campus. If it's not clear from the description and the cover sheet how frequently they do these course assessments, please do request that information. It should be clear from the methodology and description as to whether or not this is the exact same evaluation form used for on-campus courses. Again, institutions have flexibility in what they use. Some institutions use one course evaluation form clear across campus and for all students, and some institutions use differing ones for different departments and maybe add some additional questions in, for concurrent enrollment. And so what you're looking for is a description of the process. And the process by which it is reported back to the instructors and to your faculty liaisons. Evaluation standards 2 and 3 are very similar. These are the alumni surveys, concurrent enrollment alumni surveys. And the intent of this is to really gauge course transferability, how students are satisfied with their experience, and what students do with the credits that they earn through concurrent enrollment as they continue on in higher education, and really with a goal of informing program improvement as you continue to develop your programs. For evaluation standard 2, 3, and 4, programs must use the standard NACEP surveys. The templates are available to them, and they are welcome to add additional questions, but they must at least cover the questions that are in the survey templates. So please do look to see that they're using the NACEP surveys. Some common problems that arise with the evaluation 2 and 3 alumni surveys is response rate. We do not require a minimum response rate for any of these surveys. While we don't require that, programs should explain their process if they have low response rates. What are they going to do next time to increase their response rate? What type of timing are they using for administering the survey, the methods of administering the survey, the methods of contacting student alumni, and how they do follow-up. Our standards do require at a minimum that that institutions follow up with all non-respondents at least once, and that a qualified institutional evaluator or researcher works with the concurrent enrollment program. That person can be from a variety of different backgrounds, can be from a variety of different houses within the institution or an external evaluator, but we are looking to see, you should be looking to see that someone who has experience doing survey administration was involved in the administration and analysis of the survey. You do want to look and see at the analysis that they've done. What have they learned from doing the survey that they're going to use for program improvement? Sometimes this analysis will be combined with the methodology in a single report. Sometimes we'll describe the methodology separately in the program cover sheet. Evaluation 3, as I said, is again another alumni survey. This one is for students who are 4 years out of high school rather than 1 year out, which is the evaluation standard 2. The clock starts when the student graduates from high school, not based on when they took the course. So 1 year out of high school for E2 or 4 years out of high school for E3, rather than 1 year after taking the concurrent enrollment course or 4 years after taking the concurrent enrollment course. That some students may have been taking it in junior year or previous to that. Same common problems tend to happen here. We tend to see lower response rates because of students changing phone numbers, email addresses, mailing addresses. Again, one of the things to look for here in areas you can recommend is methods for tracking students and keeping in touch with students after they graduate to improve response rates. Evaluation standard 4, typically programs have less difficulty in administering and getting good responses out of their teachers, concurrent enrollment instructors, the principals of the partner high schools, as well as guidance counselors from those high schools. Now, in some cases, programs don't have very strong relationships with the principals or the guidance counselors. There may be other individuals at those in those buildings who they work with more directly. And so it's certainly okay for them to additionally survey vice principals or district level officials or other individuals in the building who are engaged in the program. But we do at a minimum require them to survey guidance counselors and principals. The questions do vary slightly between the three groups, and so you should be receiving a separate analysis of the results for each type of respondent. They may do some consolidated analysis for some of the common questions if they'd like to as well. Again, what you're looking for is to see the methodology that they've used, and as well as what they're doing with the information after they've received it. with that, why don't we continue, since we have a little bit of time still. I'm going to go ahead and unmute the line in case people would like to ask questions on the audio line in addition to the chat window. If you don't mind, if you're not speaking, if you can make sure that your phone is muted on your end so that we don't hear background noise from your offices.
And Adam, I saw that there was a question from David on the assessment standards. So I guess that's one thing I'm sure is on a lot of people's minds of how to handle things when there's variability and some disciplines are doing a great job and certainly meet and maybe even exceed the standard and other disciplines may not be totally adhering. And sometimes I have to say that this this is where things come down to, you know, we try to view everything holistically, and, you know, someone isn't necessarily, you know, denied. Like, we don't necessarily say that a standard has not been met just because there might be some disciplines that aren't doing as good a job as we'd like. It really, it's tough to give a straight answer. It depends on maybe what the disciplines are. Are these disciplines with a lot of students and what you consider to be very, you know, highly impactful kind of courses, like an English 101 class or something like that, where if there was lack of alignment, you know, that would raise a lot of flags compared to perhaps a technology or music appreciation or some other class that might be a little bit more of a niche kind of class. So some of it will depend on that and really how far behind they are, and maybe working with the applicant about, you know, what is their process of trying to improve things there. So there could be some back and forth. You know, are they training liaisons? Are they working with them? Are there signs of improvement? Does the liaison get it that they need to maybe pick up their game a bit? To improve alignment in there. So, you know, this might be something where if you come across cases like this, work closely with your coordinating commissioner to determine a best approach, because it's hard to give one generic answer that's going to work on this. So, you know, your coordinating commissioner, consider that person to be like a mentor for your team. Involve them immediately and keep them aware of your struggles, of things where there's maybe disagreements in the team about an approach or about, you know, these kinds of cases.
Your line is now unmuted.
I've gone ahead and unmuted the line, so if you have any questions you'd like to ask on the audio, please go ahead and do so now. Tim asks, what's the approve versus deny rate for accreditation applications? And I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I can look that up and get it to you, Tim.
I mean, I suppose one thing, I don't know if this, you know, I mean, the Accreditation Commission is relatively new, and maybe one thing that wasn't always clear is that it's the commission that makes the final, that makes the vote about whether to approve or deny programs, and it is possible for there to be a disagreement between the review team and the commission. You know, so that's where doing a really thorough job and really outlining very well, describing very well in your review forms and reports, things you give back to your coordinating commissioner to really make sure that it's clear what the team saw, what the opinions are and everything. If that's going to help the commissioner a lot with making a recommendation. And unfortunately, I would say, just based on past experience, that sometimes it's difficult if we don't get really detailed information to understand what was going on in the application and what the strengths and weaknesses for, and to really make a fair call about approving or denying. So
I have a question. This is Suzanne. Last year, my associate dean was also on a review team, and I can't remember what school it was, and I wouldn't say it anyway. But this college did not meet one standard, and they were approved anyway by NACEP, and I'm just wondering why that was. The review team clearly stated that there was one standard that was not met by this college that they were reviewing. I can't remember which standard it was.
So that's for some of what I was talking about in terms of the documentation that the team provides to the commissioner can be really valuable, because whenever as a commission we see that there are standards that are minimally met or not met, we then delve into the actual application evidence ourselves and almost do like a mini review, you know, just diving into those particular standards and to see. And there are times that we may disagree with the assessment of the review team about whether a standard was met or not, or might have other information that can impact that. But in addition, the team or the commission has decided that in some cases that we may approve a program, but with what is in essence a program improvement plan. And so it's almost like a conditional approval where the program's approved, but they need to show us for that one standard how they will get the processes and procedures in place to have that standard fully met by within the next academic year.
Okay.
And so
I don't recall this particular case, and certainly if a review team if you as a reviewer want to know more about the outcome after your review, you should certainly get in touch with the commissioner who was assigned to the application. I don't recall any cases where a review team recommended denial that the commission went ahead and approved the accreditation for. I'll go back and look this one up. But certainly if your dean wants to have any continued conversation about it, we would certainly welcome conversation so that we can, you know, make sure that we're communicating the concerns of the review team to the program.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions before we wrap up?
Adam, this is David. I'd just like to make a comment about the interview. I know that was a new process last year, and I think it's a good process, and I enjoyed that opportunity. There was a bit of confusion or miscommunication or something in that I think in our case the applicant felt that they addressed or responded to some of our questions during the interview and therefore did not need to submit the requested documentation or evidence. And I guess I would just ask that be communicated clearly to the applicants what the purpose of that interview really is, as you described it in the notes there.
Yeah, I recall that situation there, and I recall us all scratching our heads wondering why they hadn't submitted the information you had requested to them until they finally said, oh, we thought we had provided it during the interview.
Right.
So we will make sure that the communication to the applicants regarding the need to submit any evidence that's discussed during that meeting in writing as well is taken care of, because there was, if I recall, a month or two went by, and then they sort of had to scramble to prepare that for you.
Right. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. This is Tim at the UW. I think some of that is just how far out in advance you receive the first request for additional information. It could be a month. And so that indicates, whoa, what are you supposed to be doing between the time you read this, a couple paragraphs or a couple pages or whatever, and then you have your interview. Why so far in advance when the applicant isn't supposed to do anything about it and the review team isn't really supposed to address feedback to anything that the applicant brings with them?
Just for a person to complain about feedback coming early, Tim.
Yeah, usually we actually have the opposite problem this past year.
But that's right. You know, ultimately the deadlines are deadlines, and certainly you as an applicant are welcome to submit your response earlier. And then you could even do it before the interview if it was very clear and there was no need for sort of further conversation about the questions.
I think one thing that the interview sometimes can help do is there are times when a team might ask for something and it came out of partly just a misunderstanding of some of the stuff that was submitted, and it ends up just being something that's very simple and that actually no further evidence might have been needed in a particular area, or it was just like, oh, well, we put it over here, or oh, we thought this was kind of, and so sometimes it can help actually simplify what the applicant has to do as far as the follow-up evidence, or clarify for them, you know, what it is really that you're looking for. Because we all try to be perhaps sometimes like, you know, as succinct to the point as possible, perhaps in some of the letters, and may not, it just might not be always communicating clearly to the applicant what we really want. And, you know, the last thing we want is an applicant to go crazy and try to, like, throw the kitchen sink at us with all this information that is going to take a lot of time for the team to go through. So what you're hoping for is that that interview can really clarify for the applicant what it is that you didn't see, you know, what questions you had that weren't kind of clearly answered in the evidence they already provided, and what kinds of evidence would help the team understand, you know, what the program is doing, to, you know, hopefully help the applicant really choose wisely what kind of evidence they're going to submit as far as their follow-up, their first response.
Yeah, and I think that sounds really smart, because it's, you know, reinforcing this collaborative, collegial process. It's a discussion-based process. And then Lori Beth's note here is, you know, it's just key then to have documentation. So if the review team wants four different pieces of evidence, and during the discussion with the applicant says, oh, actually, number one, you provided in a different space, or we misunderstood, it should still be documented somehow that number one was addressed during the meeting, or, hey, this information was provided elsewhere. Just so in the case that the commission has to review something, there's something in writing for all those people who weren't at that interview meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thanks for clarifying.
Thanks. Yeah, that's helpful. There's a question about how many apps were received, Adam.
That's a good question.
I thought it was 14.
The number is 12, right. We have a couple that were given extensions until August 1 due to medical and other causes. So I think we're at 12 at the moment, and maybe we have two more still coming in.
And some of those include reaccreditations. That's for both brand new applicants and reaccreds.
Tim, that's a great question. How many peer reviewers are there currently? We're around 40. We are going to try to make it so that each peer review team is only reviewing one application. So if you have colleagues that are interested and have not signed up yet, it is not too late. Please let us know. We would love to have them on board so that we can make sure that your workload as volunteers is not more than it needs to be.
Yeah, we need two more, please.
Right, I think with that, we're coming up right on an hour and a half right now. If you have additional questions, please feel free to stay on the line, and Adam and myself and if Victoria can, we'll stay on to answer those questions. As you can see on your screen, we really want to encourage you to please register for our conference in Chicago this fall. On Monday morning, we are hosting a breakfast as our way to say thank you to you, so don't forget to join us for that. We will be putting today's slides and the audio on our website, which will be posted underneath the member resources and accreditation. It's on both those menus if you're looking for it. So if you do have colleagues who are interested in becoming a peer reviewer, first let us know, and also you can direct them towards the webinar online. So with that, thank you everybody for joining.
Bye.